Yeah, you know that when you're a real girl too, so you know that deal.
Yeah. Okay, it is December 18th. This is Jen Brown, and I'm here with Dr. Larry McKinney to finish up part two of his oral history. And for the tape, do I have your permission to record again today?
Yes, you have my permission to record. This is Larry McKinney.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so yesterday we talked a lot about some of the projects that you worked on at Parks and Wildlife. Was there anything else that you wanted to add that, or that you forgot about, or that you wanted to get on the historical record?
There was a couple I was thinking about at the end. One was dealing with menhaden, which was one of the last issues I dealt with at Parks and Wildlife. That's a fisheries thing, so I thought you might be interested in it. And the other was just kind of the end of that water discussion, and something that happened. And this was what we were talking about is that I put this program together that was to develop the inflows for all the bays and estuaries, and we produced that document over a long period of time, almost 8 or 10 years, I think. And when we started putting out the recommendations of how much water would be required to protect them, obviously it started getting a lot of attention of what I refer to as the water hustle community, which is those people that build. There's a book called Cadillac Desert, and part of this kind of comes of that. There is a community out there that they build a lot of water projects. They're teams of engineers and lawyers, and in some cases, I'm not saying all, and not in Texas necessarily, but you know, that would find places to build reservoirs, and it was how they made money. Even though the reservoir may or may not be needed, they convinced local folks to go and put in taxes and build this reservoir for economic future, and they made a lot of money off of it. But that's in Cadillac Desert. But nonetheless, anyone who wanted to build reservoirs in Texas, after our recommendations came through, knew that they would have to deal with us because we would want to set aside a significant amount of water in many cases, millions of acre feet of water, that they couldn't access and then sell and use to justify the project. So they were always watching, and as soon as the recommendations come out, they started fighting them. But this one particular incident that really brought it all to a head was dealing with the San Antonio Bay. And it goes back to my old days of working with whooping cranes. And whooping cranes were living on the shores of San Antonio Bay. But this was, we were developing the recommendations for inflows for San Antonio Bay. And there was a small conservation organization called the San Marcos River Foundation, or SMRF, as it became known, San Marcos River Foundation. And they knew we were developing inflow numbers, and they came and talked to me one day and said they were interested in applying for a permit. They had reviewed the legal proceedings, and it was clear that it was allowable for them to apply for a water permit to not build a reservoir, but simply to take the water and dedicate it to San Antonio Bay. So, but we need to know how much water we should include in our permit. And we had those numbers, so we had the science to back it up. And so we provided those numbers to them. And I even brokered a meeting with the head of the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, Bill West, who was the director then. I brought them together at a restaurant with SMRF, and because I said, you need to be above board of what you're doing, because the models actually show that the water is not there. So I don't think he'll be upset about it or too certain. He'll just say it's not possible. And indeed, the River Authority said, well, the water's not there. You can apply for a permit if you want to do it, but it's an empty exercise. And so the SMRF folks said, no, we want to do it anyway, just so we can have it to prove that you can do this. And so it was for like 1.4 million acre feet of water. And so they got an application together. They hired attorneys. They applied for that water permit and got it in line. It was officially filed. And at that, about that same time, the State Water Development Board, who made the estimations of how much water was available, they ran models to demonstrate how much water was in a river that could be permitted, and the models that they'd been using were 20 or 30 years old, and so it was time for them to revise them, and they did, and these are official results. I mean, this is what guides water development in the state of Texas when these numbers come out, and lo and behold, their new models showed that there was almost 1.5 million acre feet of water available in the Guadalupe River that was not there before. And according to first-in-line, first-in-time permitting process, the Smurf people already had a permit in. They were going to get this water. They were, you know, in the right place at the right time with the right numbers. And the whole water world exploded because, obviously, they did, no one in the state of Texas, none of the water hustle community wanted to lose kind of water like that, set that kind of precedent. But there was nothing they could do about it. They took Smurf to court, and Smurf won because these are the rules. I mean, they were playing by the rules that had been set up. And so what it boiled down to, long short, is they started down the road of getting their permit, and it finally, everything finally were exposed. The water hustle community were exposed because they went to the legislature. The next session of the legislature was coming up the next year, and basically strong-armed a bill through that disallowed water permits for environmental purposes. And the whole point of it was to eliminate, and it was very specific, although it's not, you shouldn't have been able to do this in the legislature. They don't do things like this, but they did for this. So they were making that point, and I was really upset about it, concerning. And of course, they were the community was attacking me directly on our program, really hard on. And I was talking to our then commission chair, complaining about it. And I'll think of his name in here in a second. And he was kind of smiling about it. And I said, well, you know, why are you, what? Said, well, I'm upset, but why are you smiling about all this stuff? He said, well, I say, Larry, what you need to understand, he says, they're not, these people are not complaining about your science. They're not getting after you about your science. They just don't like the answer. And so that's what it was, that's what it's all about. And so it just made the point on the water side of things that this is a big political game, and it was a long-term game, and it's really important that you have to have strong advocates and the science, but even then, politics does play a role. And so that was our lesson. It was not a good lesson going forward, but it just showed it made it more difficult. Now, we came at that in a whole different way, thanks to Bob Bullock, Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, one of probably the last true statesmen in the state of Texas, a politician that could really think on a big scale into the future, not worry about who's going to vote for them, you know, next. That, you know, as people, though, story goes that a politician's future is only if it goes so far as the next election. Well, he was one of those few types of people that thought well beyond that. And so he became very interested in water, making sure that Texas had water, not environment, but just for everything. But in that process, I was part of it. He asked me to be part of his team. And I wrote the environmental parts of Senate Bill 1, 2, and 3, and also Paul Montagna at HRI before he was with HRI. I worked on this thing as well, and he was a big player in it. So we got a process in to allow to make sure that environmental water was set aside before the permitting process. So and that's in effect now, and it does work. And so we did get the problem more or less solved, or at least on a good path. But that was a really difficult time when we had that was a bad time when the legislature basically said we're not going to set aside environmental water.
And what years was this in the Senate bills?
Let's see, Smurf, that was mid-1990s, that period of time.
Okay.
Right in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was that one. The other one was a Menhaden one, another controversial one. You know, Menhaden are a filter-feeding fish. They form huge schools, millions and millions of Menhaden. I've had the opportunity when I've been in the Gulf on different projects to actually dive in the middle of a Menhaden school. There was a time I was doing some work between two oil and gas platforms. I was drifting between the platforms collecting data. And so the water was 300 or 400 feet deep. And I was maintaining a depth of probably about 60 feet trying to do that and collecting data in a particular water column. And we had the current set up, and I had an indicator above me so that the boats could keep track of me, but it was my whole goal was to hold that depth and take that data. And as I was drifting out over the middle of the ocean, a giant school of menhaden came through, millions of menhaden came right through me, came right over me. Of course, they gave me a distance, they went around me, and it was like, I guess the best thing I call it was like being inside, because they're silverfish, and the sun was shining in, and so they're very reflective. And so it was like being inside a disco ball about the size of a basketball gym, because they cleared that space around me, but just kept going. And so it was very disorienting, but it took them 3 or 4 minutes for that school to get by me. And so there were millions of menhaden in it. But anyway, that's a sidebar story. But they're very important as a forage fish to the Gulf. But also, there's a huge industry, a big netting industry, that will use airplanes and big ships. They'll find these schools from the air, surround them, and collect up the entire school. And often there will be dolphins and turtles, redfish, and all other kinds of fish in there. And most of those are killed or lost. And it's a big mortality event. They don't do this. They control it better now, but then it was pretty bad. And basically, they turn those. They use the menhaden to produce omega-3 oils. That's one thing they get out of it. Mostly, it's dog food and food for salmon and aquaculture and things like that. So, but menhaden are fundamental forage fish for all kinds of sport fish. So they have huge economic impact on that kind of industry. And if they're not there, of course, that depresses the populations of recreational species. The biggest industry is on the East Coast. But there is a big industry in the Gulf, and what we were seeing, or what I was watching and seeing there, was the industry on the East Coast were fishing all the menhaden. Now, Chesapeake Bay is the main place for this, and they were decimating the population because they're such an efficient fishery, and the menhaden forms these big schools. And it was clear to many of us that the menhaden fishery itself, the industry, was going to be looking for a new place to come. Once they depleted all the menhaden on the East Coast and the Gulf and the Mississippi River, off the Mississippi River was the obvious place. And we could not get the federal agencies to do anything about it because they're very oriented toward commercial fisheries and they were not going to do it. So I started looking, well, what could I do? And since Texas has an extended coastal zone out beyond the normal 3-mile limits, we control out the 9-mile limits, I convinced the commission that we should limit the menhaden fishery in Texas waters. We're not going to eliminate it. I'm not going to eliminate an industry because that would have set off a lot of alarms. But I said, I want to make sure that the industry can take no more menhaden than they are taking right now. So if they try to come in and take more than their historic average, they can't do it. So I won't hurt the industry, but I'm not going to let it grow in Texas because we need to reserve those menhaden for redfish and other game fish that are economically important to the coast and so forth. And so the fight got going. That was one of the times that I had two different legislatures tell me that if I didn't drop that rule, I would be fired from it. Because it got really heated. The industry got real nasty. They hired a lobby group that came in and basically tried to label me as a communist. They went on record in a hearing doing that, and it was, so it was, they got real serious about it. What they didn't know at the time, though, is that the chair of the commission was a gentleman named Peter Holt of the Caterpillar family fame. He was a very practical, very straightforward fellow, and very, very conservation-oriented. It just so happened he knew... He had had dealings with a particular company, this menhaden company, and knew it well and knew what they did. He actually came to me and because he was getting that same kind of pressure, really hard pressure, and he just came and says, Larry, don't worry about it. You're covered. You do the science, and if you can make the case in front of the commission, we'll do it. And so this is another one of these times where my commission, the political arm of the agency, because they were conservation oriented and didn't have to worry about people like this, they gave me the cover, and we went on and did that. And we're the only state that has limited it. Florida has now tried to do it, but we now have protected our population. And in fact, the menhaden fishery has begun to increase in the Gulf because of those very reasons. So that was one of the last little things I got done before I retired from Parks and Wildlife. But that's, I put a little check mark by that one, that's something that, that we'll have done that will have some real long-term impacts. So that was the That was a story.
Yeah, it's good to have success stories in this.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, no, that's, I want to kind of balance off that really kind of downer with the water side of things. Okay, there, we, you know, you lose some, you win some, and your goal is to keep the winning numbers, you know, as high as you can. But you have to recognize you will lose some in this game, and you're not going to win them all.
Mm-hmm. And some of these issues you brought over to Hart, right, of freshwater and
yeah, no, all, yeah, this forage one, in fact, was a big one. And when we went into that commission, the Recreational Fisheries Commission, that was one of the items that I got put in there to deal with, to make sure you deal with forage fish, that we need to do it. Yeah.
Nice. So. Okay, well, let's shift over to your time at the Hart Research Institute. So
can
you tell me how you got the job, why you were interested, that sort of thing?
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, I had not ever actually planned to do this. I was quite content at Parks and Wildlife, although after 23 years there, I was thinking about that I probably should think about retiring. I'd been the head of coastal fisheries for almost 10 years. At that time, and I do think it's important that leadership change on a regular basis, and for some reason 10 years has always been in a cycle that about that time it's time to change, and so I was thinking about doing that, and at the time we were pursuing the shrimp buyback program that we talked about, and I was contacted by Will Hart, which is one of Ed Hart's sons, and Will and Ed were real interested in the buyback program. They liked the concept, and they wanted to lead an effort to bring in private money to help us do this project. And I thought that was wonderful, and they did exactly that. And they brought in some millions of dollars, actually, to actually add to the license to buyback. So Will and I established a relationship from that because of his interest in that program that we started. And subsequent to that, out of the blue, he contacted me, and of course, I was very much aware of the Hart Research Institute, the funding that Ed had set aside, and I was very good friends with Wes Tunnel. He and I were in graduate school together, and so it was very exciting to see them start the program up and get it going. I was following it really closely, and Will came to me and said, we want to have someone directing Hart as its first science director that really thinks like we do, and said, and we like what you did with that shrimp buyback program and how you come at things, and would you think about, you know, coming over and taking what you learned at Parks and Wildlife and helping us build an institute that considers those types of things. And so back and forth, I started thinking about it and talking with Ed and looking at all the scientists that were already here. There were a number of them here, Paul Montagna and Rich McLaughlin, Jim Jabot, for example. And so I began to convince myself, say, you know, this could be a wonderful legacy. I mean, I've spent 23 years learning a lot of tough lessons here at Parks and Wildlife of how to solve problems and how to deal with resource issues and in a very, what I thought was a very effective way. And we had, as I said, we had some wins and losses, but I thought the approach was a good one. And so this would give me an opportunity to take all those things that I had learned after 23 years or so, and maybe pass them on, and to make bring them into a kind of academic setting and help the students become better at this type of thing, and also have an institute that could really take this on and be very focused. So that's really what was my final decision to apply for the position, with the idea that HRI was basically organized around the very same ideals that I had come to recognize as particularly effective in taking science and solving problems to the benefit of the environment. And so that's what I did.
And so when you started, can you tell me about your goals and kind of deciding on what projects and what focus and what science you wanted to conduct?
Kind of come out.
Yeah.
Yeah. A part of it, of course, had to do with Ed, whom I unfortunately didn't know Ed long. I mean, unfortunately, he passed before I could know him well, but I knew him a bit. Of course, Will, I did know well, and Will was very close with his dad. And so I knew enough and had the conversation with Ed and looked at how the HRI was organized. And Ed always had a couple of real simple things he approached things at, as you're basically talking about. If you're going to do something, do it really well. That was my father, I could hear my father in the back of that. And that came down to a little trope that we use, which we ascribed to Ed, which is all he wanted us to do was make a difference. And that was kind of what we came at. So that was there. I like that. The Institute was very much focused on problem solving, a very practical science. That was certainly what I was interested in. And a little sidebar issue that Ed was a very internationalist. He was he really felt it's important that the Gulf of Mexico was not just a U.S. water. It was Cuba and Mexico. And of course, I had spent a good part of my work in my dissertation in Mexico. I had not gone to Cuba because of the difficulties then, but I was all over the Caribbean, so I really had an appreciation for it. So all those things linked together. HRI had a wonderful advisory committee led by Sylvia Earle, but she had put together some really, top-notch scientists and others, not just scientists, but broad thinkers. And when they designed HRI, they had this concept of a transdisciplinary body that they didn't want an institute that just had biologists and chemists and geologists. That was fine, but there are lots of marine science institutes like that. The one across the bay, the University of Texas Marine Science Institute, it's the oldest in the state. Wonderful institute, great scientists, but very focused on the physical sciences. And Ed recognized, as I did, that if you're going to solve problems with science, you better understand people. And we've had that discussion that people and my old trope that I use that people are part of the environment, both problems and solutions. So you have to think about that. And so that advisory committee came up, understood that. And so they made sure that they wanted a chair in economics and a chair in marine policy and law. In fact, the very first chair, Rich McLaughlin, who was hired here, is an attorney and an expert in marine policy and law. So they got that idea. So that rang really, really well with me. And that was the basic, one of the basic concepts that they came up with, this transition. And they not only did it in the chairs, they designed the entire building, the HRI building, with an open concept and with the idea of chairs would have offices at opposite ends of galleries, and the students would be in between, and a graduate student that was an economist would be sitting next to a graduate student that might be a biologist or a geologist. And so the idea of being in one space to build that interaction. Because there's many institutes now who have taken this up, by the way. When they were designing this back after 2000, that was 20 years ago, no one was thinking about this much. So it was very unique. But others have now recognized this, and so they have these transdisciplinary institutes. But for the most part, it's in the cyberspace. They're not actually in the same building. They're not physically together. So they made sure that they did that. Where we were very lucky here in the original organization is that the chairs, our original chairs, the Paul Montagna and Rich McLaughlin and all the others, they were scientists who were very interested in this very concept too. They were good scientists, excellent scientists on their own, but they were interested in taking their science and solving problems. And so they had that attitude. And so, because this was not going to be an institute for a basic science, who just wanted to do their science, write their papers, and then go on to the next issue. They wanted to do these things. So they were there, and they're very collegial. And that's where I've been lucky, both at Parks and Wildlife and here, is that, now you may not believe this, but some faculty members, some researchers can be quite prima donnas. I know it's hard to believe, but in academia, they a few of them can be that. And there's a few I know that I wonder how they could get in the door. Their heads are so big, I don't know how they get through the door. But anyway, I'm almost joking. But they typically are very focused on their own issues, and that's why they're probably successful, because they're laser focused and this thing. But we were very fortunate in this group here that I came together with David Yoskowitz, who's now the new director, and Jabot and others, Jim Jabot, and the whole group, Greg Stuns. They have really worked well together ever since I've been here, and they support one another, and their students work together. So it's been a very collaborative it's transdisciplinary, yes, because of this, but it's very collaborative. And so that has been a secret that many other institutes may not have been able to do. So we were fortunate in the chairs that were brought together here. So that's that one basic transdisciplinary way. That was an important feature of Parks for Health, that, I mean, of HRI that made us successful. The other area that has been unique about HRI is, as I've talked about, we are very focused on the world around us. And what I've come to appreciate about academia, because I was in academia before I was at Parks and Wildlife for about 10 years, then 20 years there, and then here for almost 12. And so I've had that opportunity to kind of compare both. And what I have seen in academia has been a constant pressure to get kind of isolated. And I think it's a real problem for academia. It's one of the reasons that science has begun to lose traction. We talked about that a little bit, is that in some sense, academia has built this bubble around itself and has not interacted with the world like it used to or it should. And so it's kind of become a separate entity with academia focused on doing its research, writing its papers, working with the students, and then going that cycle. And they measure success by the numbers of papers, peer-reviewed papers that are written and their impact and those types of things, and less so perhaps with understanding what's going on in the world and trying to solve those problems. Now, you need that type of thing. I don't want to say that you don't. That what some people call basic research or discovery research, you need that. But you also need scientists that are interacting with the world around them and making those connections. And that's what HRI really is focused on, is to do that. And of course, I was so concerned about it, I put together a workshop. One of our key researchers here, a young woman named Dr. Katya Woke, and I, in particular, we brought some of the leading folks in this issue together. I mean, the former director of the National Science Foundation and Woods Hole and a whole group of folks, international, to talk about how do we make academia more relevant, because we wanted to make sure we did that. And of course, what did we do as academics? We wrote a paper, of course.
You know, I tried to find that paper this morning, but the link won't work in the library, so I have to interlibrary.
Okay. I'll get it to you. I'll send it to you. Yeah. Of course, I've got it. I'll send it to you. And it was really a wonderful exercise, and just talking about the need, and this is a constant battle, is that the academicians, faculty members still do not get credit for engaging, and I'll talk about that in a second, with the community around them. They do it all the time, but when academics talk about engagement, they typically talk about committees, internal committees and professional societies and all that, all of which you need, but they get no credit for engaging with people around them. And so that's part of this problem. If you don't get credit for it, you can understand why they don't do it. It doesn't help gain tenure. It doesn't help gain promotion. And so our point was trying to encourage academia to broaden that horizon and do that. I started that conference off with one of my favorite historians. It's a fellow named Page Smith. You probably never heard of Page Smith, but he was an old time historian. You know, I read him a lot now. And he and people like he and Shelby Foote, you may know Shelby mm-hmm. Foote,
yeah.
Of course, from the Civil War deal. And Shelby and Page are the old-time narrative historians. I call them. They do history by narrative. And, of course, the more trend nowadays is more kind of an analytical history, quantitative type things. And so those guys didn't like that. They thought we lost something in it. Page had this famous statement that I started this workshop with. And his statement was is that, "The vast majority of the so-called research turned out in the modern university is essentially worthless. It does not result in any measurable benefit to anybody or anything. It is busy work on a vast, almost incomprehensible scale." So I love that statement, and I used it for this. You know, and of course, he didn't care about the statistics, but of course, the statistical historian did. And the point is, the reality is, and I can't remember who did this work. I have to find the citation, but I had the quotes here. But the fact is that 98% of the articles published in arts and humanities are never cited by another researcher. In social sciences, it's 75% are never read once they're published. And even in the what we call the hard sciences, the natural sciences, 25% of those articles are never used either. So there is some real evidence, even if you're not a if you're not a fan of narrative histories, there are some real evidence to that point. So that was the point of what I was trying to get at. And I guess Shelby and he in particular, Page, because he was really, I know it's an inflammatory statement, and you know, but I love gigging my, and I use it every once in a while. I always get this shocked at meetings when I use that. You hear this kind of shocked silence that I would even say something like that. But anyway, and I'd appreciate it. I guess I liked it. I liked Page because as a narrative person, you know, I think of myself more as a naturalist as well. I'm not a particularly good quantitative scientist, which probably relates to my dyslexia, which I have pretty severe dyslexia, and I've had to try to deal with it all through school, and I've managed. I mean, I never really had any professional help with it, but I keep, because I'm interested in it, of the whole concept, and so I've found ways to adapt. And so numbers are particularly hard for me because I twist them up all the time, so I have to be very focused and work on it. So when I'm writing or doing research, and maybe that's helped me focus because I have to stay razor focused on it. And I do pretty good, although I really messed it up about a year ago. The Gulf Fisheries Council was considering allowing shrimpers to do away with their fish bycatch devices. We talked about turtle bycatch devices. There's also devices to help keep fish out of those nets, particularly red snapper. And they take, and the bars are essentially much more closer, and so they take out even more shrimp. So the more shrimp are lost, less efficient. And so this has been going on for years, and the shrimp industry was trying to make the case that the snapper fishery was so well established now it didn't matter if they took more snapper, that they could increase their efficiencies and try to make the case. So I wrote a pretty not nasty, but a pretty pointed editorial that was published in several national magazines, saying that they shouldn't be allowed. And I had done some calculations about the impact of the numbers of snappers that were being lost, and I flipped decimal. I flipped a decimal place for the number. I mean, I just literally did that. And I didn't, you know, I always had ways to catch myself. It's got to check it and check it. And this one got by me, and I haven't missed this. And so it made it appear that their impact was 2 to 4 times greater than it really was. Well, it didn't take long for my, one of my colleagues here on the other side of the issue, I know him quite well, a fellow named Benny Galloway. We're very good friends, but we have opposite views. And he pointed out, and so I had to do a retraction, so it was very embarrassing, and I probably hurt the cause of the other side. So anyway, I'm sure I got off on a tangent there, but that just making the point, you know, I have to be really careful, that type of thing, and that's why I guess I'm more of a naturalist than a quantitative biologist, because I get myself in trouble. Anyway, I didn't mean to get, where were we? I got off on a point, I really got off on a tangent, sorry about that. We're talking about academia being kind of outside there, and that's what HR tries not to be. And one of the ways we came at it, and this is something I think it comes at the heart of HRI and the heart of everything that we've done that I've worked on here, is that we develop what we call this HRI model based on all these experiences and how we come at things. And that's been the heart of what we've done, and one of the reasons I've enjoyed working here. And that model—it's kind of at the core of what we do, and it's really—it's really engagement-oriented. It basically says when we identify problems, you need to be engaged with those people who are dealing with the problems. Over and over, academics and scientists think they know the problem because they see it from their perspective, but we really don't. Most of the time, it's the people who are experiencing the problem. You have to talk with them to see what their problem is and how they see it, because it might mean, and it'll give you a whole different perspective. So that's one part of the model. Now, once you understand what the problem is and try to solve, come up with a solution, what we recognize here at the Institute, that we don't have all the expertise. We've got a lot of expertise, but we don't have all of it. So you have to have the capability to bring in other people, other expertise, to focus on what the problem is and solve them. So we engage with our own scientific community, which is important. And then the third part of that model is where this is where academia drops off. And they were talking about they have most academics have no interest in this. It is taking the science and actually implementing a solution, because that gets messy. Most academia stop at that second stage and start the process over again. They put the solution out there. They hope somebody takes it up, or maybe it just becomes shelf art because no one ever looks at it again. But we actively engage with regulators, with managers and private industry and others to actually solve those problems. And that could be dangerous. That's where you get into this advocacy business or being accused of advocacy. We try to be very careful with that, that we're laying out options and we give them the best science available and that type of thing. But that's the third part of that model. And so we try to, that's how we try to come at things with our model. And that's, no one really does that much. Even now, we're one of the few academic organizations that really do get engaged in that very dangerous third element of our model to some degree. It's dangerous professionally. And that's where I guess my strength has been, and where I think it's important that heads of institute like HRI have that experience, not just be academic, not just be agency, but have that mix where you can kind of see both worlds and make sure you kind of keep that balance. And that's why we've been successful. I guess the last element of the HRI kind of model of why it works is credibility. If you're going to do this type of thing, you really have to be credible. You have credibility is difficult to, as the definition goes or the saying goes, it's difficult to build credibility, but you can lose it in an instant. Just like I was talking about that shrimp deal, that was a kind of situation like that you can't do it. And we've been really fortunate here. And that we have some excellent scientists. I mean, we have two Regents professors. Those are really rare, Greg Stund and Paul Montagna. All of our scientists are regionally, even have regional or national reputations. You know, they publish at the highest end. I just found out that's one of our folks did an analysis a couple of weeks ago. I don't know who was doing, where this was coming from, but he discovered that Paul Montagna is considered in the top 2% of the world's most influential scientists.
Uh-huh.
And so, and he's the only one from this university that's in that list. So we do have really, really bright and well-known people. And that helps you carry the day in arguments when you have that kind of argument. So we do that. And the other thing that helps in that regard, in the credibility side, is that we're actually at a small regional school, university. If the institute were part of what we call the mothership at College Station, if we were located there, we'd just be another cog in a huge machine, because they have lots of institutes. And now we're a pretty big one in one sense, but they have lots of them there. And so we would just be in the mix. But here at this university, we're a much more substantial part of the university. We have a lot more independence than we might have at College Station. And we get greater support from the university than we would ever get in College Station to move forward. So it allows us a lot of flexibility to do things that would never happen if we're in College Station. So our being located at a smaller, quote-unquote, smaller school, I've always felt is a great advantage, not a disadvantage. Some people would consider that because it's a prestige thing. You know, academia is all that way. But again, our where we operate is not in the academic world necessarily. We're part of it, but we're trying to work in a bigger area. And so credibility is a different definition outside of academia. It's part of it, but it's a little bit different. So I think we've been really effective in that way. And then there's the international side. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm rambling again. So I don't want to get back to your question. But I think those are kind of the three parts of HRI, I think, that has made it really work. And it's why I've been really interested and I'm still here and trying to help make that that move forward. And it's been successful for us. When I first came here, 2008, we had about a $2 million a year budget, and we had, I think, 30 people or something like that. And today, our operating budget is 25 to 27 million a year. And we have anywhere from 150 to 170 students and staff at the institute. So in a 10-year period, we've really we've really grown. In fact, we're at the point now where David, Dr. Yaskowitz, the new director and other, they're really having to have a discussion. Do we want to get any bigger? Maybe we're where we need to be. And you know, we're adding a few chairs here and there, but do we necessarily want to become this behemoth, or can we be at this size, be really agile and effective? Because that's really his goal, and then all of our goals. We're not interested in growth for growth's sake. We could take on all, we've turned down grants and contracts just because we're not interested in busy work. We don't need that. We try to focus on those kind of grants and money and funding opportunities where we can actually go toward and solve a particular problem. That's what we try to focus on. So we've been fortunate in that regard because our chairs are so effective. I mean, their success rate on grants is in the 20% range, and overall, if you're somewhere close to 10, you're considered super effective anywhere. But these guys are there, so they're comfortable in having the funding to support their students and their staff and all that. So it gives them the luxury when we're working together to focus on really serious problems like fisheries problems that we're doing and some of these others and really make an impact. So that's our goal. So that's what even in these hard times, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary at this institute. We're having those thoughts about, okay, are we where we need to be and just need to hold this and try to be good, or can we be effective if we're larger? It's a good problem to have, but we're struggling with it.
Yeah, and I mean, when you were a director, how did you deal with that growth? Because it seems like it creates a lot of problems on kind of the backside of things.
Well, I thought we needed it. I spent most of my time promoting it. I thought the institute was just not big enough to be impactful. We had to be on par with other institutes in other states, at a certain level. We had to have a reputation. For example, we didn't have hardly any type of thing when I started here. We were just getting started. So I spent probably the first 5 or 6 years I was here. I was very seldom at the institute. I was traveling 2 or 3 times a month, participating in workshops, leading this or that, and I encourage our other chairs to do it too. Just establishing that HRI was a player, that we had things to bring and to build partnerships. Some folks, and even academia, don't recognize that when you're putting out proposals, yes, you must have a good background, you must propose good science, but there's a lot of that around. And so where you come from, the reputation of the institute of which you are a part, can be that deciding factor of whether you get that grant or not when all other things are equal. So we have to be on par with those. And so that's what I spent my time trying to do, is to make sure, one, everyone in the Gulf knew we were here and nationally, and making sure that we were engaged with them and that type of thing. So I thought we needed to grow. I have to admit, I did not think we could grow as quickly as we could. I never thought we would be where we are today, to have to be of concern that we might be getting too large, or we don't want to go any larger. What really put us over the top was the biggest environmental tragedy in this country, or one of them, certainly in the Gulf, which is the Deepwater Horizon. The institute was in the right place at the right time for this really unfortunate event to really make a contribution to addressing those issues. Because we, right before April 2010, I had put together the final set of chairs, the 6 chairs that I thought was the core. Dr. Yaskowitz came on board as an economist. Dr. Stuns came on board in the fishery side. We already had Dr. Jabot in geosciences, Paul Montagna in ecosystem, and Rich McLaughlin in the policy and law, and a good cadre of researchers around them. They were not chairs, but really good researchers. And when Deepwater Horizon struck, I brought all of us together to say, okay, this is clearly going to be a big issue. We need to think about how we can address these issues to be part of trying to, one, solve this issue, but also recover from it. And we'd never done this before, thought about this, but we started going around the room as to who has had experience in oil spills. Now, before, when I was at Parks and Wildlife, I started the oil response program, which started after Exxon Valdez, the natural resource trustee program came part of that. And so I was the state's first natural resource trustee, and I started the entire program for the state about how to respond to oil spills with other agencies. So I led that for Parks and Wildlife. And so I had responded, led responses to every oil spill that had occurred over that 23 years at Parks and Wildlife. So I'd had all that experience. But Jim Jabot had led the shoreline assessments for Exxon Valdez, and Paul and West Tunnel had been the lead scientist for the Ixtoc oil spill, which until that time was the largest oil spill that had occurred in the Gulf of Mexico, down in Mexico. And Paul Montagna had been studying oil spills and impacts like that. So we had this incredible array of expertise in oil spills that we had never even thought about before that, bringing it together. And so we laid out a strategy together about how to where we should be working with our counterparts in federal agencies and other universities to go forward, so that's how that kind of launched with it. So that's where it started. One of the things that I worked on there is that when the British Petroleum Group said, okay, as the spill was going on, they said BP said we're going to set up a $500 million research program for the Gulf of Mexico. And we're going to turn it over to scientists, and it's going to be independent. And they announced their board, the Gulf of Mexico Research Institute, GOMRI, as we called it. They announced their 10-person board that was going to oversee the entire Gulf of Mexico $500 million 10-year research program. And there was not a single person from the Gulf of Mexico on that board. And I just blew up. And actually, several other people phoned me, who's head of the Florida Institute of Oceanography, Bill Hogarth, at the same time did it, Dr. Chris Delia, who is the head of LSU's marine science programs, and several others. We all kind of independently blew up, and we knew one another. So we got on a call and said, this is crazy. This is ridiculous. And so we formed an organization called the Gulf of Mexico University Research Collaborative. It's still going today, GOMRI, with the whole idea of promoting Gulf scientists, because we knew we had really good scientists here in the Gulf of Mexico. And we went to, and we used that organization to go to Congress. And we all got in planes, and we went and talked to our respective congressmen. And at that time, several of our states had very powerful senators and others. They still do. And it was incredibly powerful for all five Gulf states scientists to come together and support one another. They had not seen that before, and we made that case, and that word got out, got back to BP and others, because Congress put the political pressure on them, and they opened up that entire GOMRI program to now include 10 members from the Gulf states as well. So we broadened that out, and then that program went forward, and it became one of the most effective research programs ever in the Gulf of Mexico. They just concluded, it was a 10-year program, they just concluded last year. And the research that group supported we've learned more about the Gulf of Mexico in the last 10 years than in all the years before. And a big part of that credit goes to how GOMRI came at it. So I'm quite proud of that group. Many of our scientists were part of it. Paul McClendon did a lot of research. All of our scientists had pieces of research in that thing. I didn't do anything there except dealing with the data side of things, but that was our role as into. That's what really got people's attention about HRI. Dr. Jabot set up what was called Grid C. We went up to visit with the people in Alaska who had studied the Alaska spill to learn some lessons from them. How do you do the research necessary to follow up on those spills? And one of the things that they said was a big mistake there is that they did not make sure that all the data and science that was generated from that spill was available. There was millions of dollars spent on research. Much of that data has never seen the light of day. They're on CDs, probably, or in file cabinets of scientists. So we convinced GOMRI that they needed to set up an organization, a structure that required that all data generated by that $500 million worth of research was recorded and available to anyone, and that was the Grid C program. And Dr. Jabot here at HRI designed that entire program, and he did a wonderful job. It's now a national model. I'm rambling again, But that's how we, that's how HRI's reputation grew, when people like Dr. Jabot and Montagne and Dr. Oskowitz, who was an economist who no one had ever taken an oil spill and cost out a dollar impact from what happens to when wetlands are lost. He did that, things like that. So our reputation just exploded over that period of time, and we've continued to build on it.
Couple follow-up questions on that. Why the Valdez oil spill, not Ixtoc, to lead to changes in Texas? And then in talking about, like, discovering new stuff about the Gulf, like, what sorts of, like, great discoveries came out of that?
Okay. So the question being is, why did we learn things from Exxon Valdez and not Ixtoc? Because Ixtoc, this was an oil spill that occurred off the Yucatan of Mexico, of course, and it was in the 70s. And it was a very similar thing to Deepwater Horizon, although it was in shallower water. But the well collapsed, and the whole surface of the Gulf there started burning, and millions of gallons of oil came forward. And in this case, that oil, but because of currents, came right at Texas. Now, Texas was not greatly impacted by Deepwater Horizon, but we were the only ones that got hit by Ixtoc. And there's pictures of Padre National Seashore. The entire beach looked like a two-lane paved road with asphalt, entirely oiled. And so it was difficult. One of the things that I did when I was a part of that studies there is that we recommended that we should close Cedar Bayou, because the one thing that acted as a natural barrier for us here in Texas, our estuaries, were the islands. They kept the oil from getting back into the bays, except through passes. And so we bulldozed closed Cedar Bayou, for example, and things like that. But the problem was that oil spill was in Mexico. Pemex would not allow a lot of work there, wouldn't allow anyone, you know, close to it much. West Tunnel was trying to do the studies, and so he did some of those studies, and many studies were funded, but as soon as that well was capped, the funding for those studies were cut off, even in the U.S. And so very little was ever published. I mean, we have all the literature that was published at that spill, but very little of it was published and not followed up on. So there were not many lessons that could be learned from that spill, because the research just did not happen. On the other hand, Exxon Valdez, it was very well studied, and a lot of information gathered from it. So that's the answer to that question.
Okay.
I can't remember what was your other
one? The discoveries in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Just a couple, for example. We did not understand, how oil, for example, acted a mile under the water. I mean, the Deepwater Horizon occurred in mile deep water. And we were used to oil spills in bays or shallow water or that type of thing. So the water immediately bubbled to the surface and created slicks. So all of our responses to oil spills, cleaning them up, mitigating them, was predicated on oil being on the surface of the water and on top of the waves washing into wetlands or over oyster reefs and things like that. Well, what happened with the oil from Deepwater Horizon, it came out of the bottom of the Gulf, much like you would take a can of air freshener, turning it on its side and push the button and spraying that column air freshener straight up. It created underwater plumes, clouds, that an occurrence took those clouds and spread them around the deep Gulf. And along the edge of the Gulf, we have a continental slope that we have very extensive shallow areas around the Gulf of Mexico that are very shallow water, but then they drop off in a shelf-like structure to the deeps. And so the currents took that cloud of oil, and it's just like in a bathtub. It just coated the margins of the continental slopes like the edge of like a bathtub ring, and all that oil spread there. We have no way of cleaning up oil that's dispersed in water columns. So that was one thing. So, and studying that afterwards, we now know much more about how the deep Gulf of Mexico is connected to the surface waters and that to the coastal waters. We have a much better understanding of how nutrients move in the Gulf of Mexico, how fish and wildlife move throughout the Gulf of Mexico and currents and those types of things. So that's some of the things that we learn. And just, you know, so much science was done in understanding the deep fish and invertebrates. We know more about those. We have better understanding about how the coastal and estuarine waters interact with one another because of the studies, those types of things. So what we know, and of course there's very specific studies on different fish groups and animal groups, so all that is there that just hadn't been done before. So in a combination, it's incredible. I was talking to Dr. Jabot about it the other some time ago, and we were talking about the amount of data that was generated. And I have a little bit of understanding about terabytes and things like that from computers. We all kind of hear about it, but I didn't know much about petabytes, for example. And so he was talking about petabytes of data that were part of what we've learned about the Gulf, and I couldn't put my hands around a petabyte. I didn't know what that meant. It sounded kind of weird. And so basically said, okay, Larry, said, right now in the Gulf, we're probably in Gomery and other work related to Deepwater Horizon, we're probably going to generate 2 to 3 petabytes of data. And said, here, if you 1 petabyte of data, here's what it is. If you took all the books and all the libraries and all the universities in the United States and digitized them, that would be 1. So all the books and all the libraries and all the universities, that's knowledge that's there. We're doubling that. So it's just, so we don't know what we know right now. There's a lot of things that we have all the data, we have all the studies, so we learn what's in those studies, but no one has yet synthesized all that and taken a look at how they all interact. That's what's going to be going on now and what's happening now, and that's the exciting part of discovery science in Gulf of Mexico. We're now taking advantage of all that research we did in response to this horrible tragedy to actually turn it into something good, I think, and that over the next 10 to 20 years will be the focus of what we do here in the Gulf of Mexico, and that will have implications all around the world. So from a research and science standpoint, it's really exciting times if we get a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or someone gets to do it. I'm not going to do it, but someone's going to get a chance to do it.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty neat. Speaking of around the world, so last time yesterday you talked about being a biopolitician. yeah. But it seems like at heart you're now you became a biodiplomat because of the international science. And can you talk more about that?
Yeah, it's I've really enjoyed that part of it, and it's been challenging in some sense. Ed Hart was committed internationalist. He loved Mexico. He understood that if we're going to solve problems in the Gulf of Mexico whole, you had to deal with Mexico and Cuba. In fact, the very first meeting of the HRI's advisory committee before I came, when they were starting, they held it in Havana, Cuba. They went there to look at it. So that's there. But I also believe that because, my own experience has been working on my doctoral dissertation, and the animals I worked with were clearly in Mexico and Cuba, the Caribbean, all that. So I had a natural tendency toward it. And that was part of the mission that Ed charged us with, is you're going to deal with international. So it was clear that I needed, as far as my leadership side of things, one of my obligations was to develop that. And it was really fortunate in that West Tunnel, who is really the kind of the heart, not kind of, he is, he really put HRI together. We call him the soul of HRI. I mean, it was, his visions and things that have much directed us here. He was a fellow in Gulf of Mexico, Mexico. I'm trying to think what the name of the international fellow is. I'm blanking out. But he did a lot of research in Mexico and himself, so he was committed there as well and had great friends in both Mexico and Cuba. A Fulbright. He was a Fulbright fellow, and that's a very prestigious thing he did in Mexico. So I started trying to figure out what how can we build these relationships. So I said, well, there's two ways to go. One, we have to build a relationship with students for the future, but we need something like right now so that we can make those connections. So I came up with the idea of setting up a chair, an international chair, one in Cuba and one in Mexico. And I talked to the president about that, and she was very supportive. And I talked to the HRI Foundation about what I wanted to do, and they were too. In fact, they said, we'll put money into it. Dr. Joe Hornblower, who is the attorney, member of the foundation, and Ed himself set aside almost $1.5 million and set up a separate Ferguson Fellowship Fund to support international work. So now we have Dr. Nuno Simoes, who's at the University of Mexico in Sisal down in the Yucatan. He has been an international chair for a couple of years. And Patricia Garza, who's the head of the University of Havana Marine Science Institute. She's the other chair, and so we work with them just as they are, as if they were HRI chairs, and we do joint research programs and that type of thing. So that has established a really wonderful link at the professional level. Then trying to think about how to get students involved, I came up with this idea of, okay, let's pick students in the U.S. and Mexico and Cuba, graduate students, primarily doctoral, but it could be master's. And let's bring them together, and we'll move this program around the Gulf. We'll meet in Cuba and Mexico and the U.S. on a regular basis, and we'll bring these students together there and let them interact with local experts and address a particular problem. Whatever the host country wanted them to work on, they will do that. The idea being to help these young doctoral and master's students make connections internationally, so that when they got out in the world of doing research, they'd be comfortable. They'd have colleagues that they would already know in Mexico and Cuba, and they would be comfortable in working in the international scene, so they will begin to build a network. And they will have not only a network between themselves, but with existing experts in those countries. So that would help promote all that. And it did have one interesting side effect. Our very first one, in our very first workshop we held here in Corpus Christi, and it was the focus of the research of the workshop was, can we build an international network of marine protected areas between Mexico and Cuba and the U.S. that would help all of our countries work better to protect and preserve the Gulf of Mexico? And so they developed a lot of work in that area and produced the paper and people moved on to the next one. Well, a few years later, when President Obama came in and improved relationships with Cuba, and he went to Cuba. One of the things that he wanted to do was to come up with some joint projects. Well, the very first project that they came up with, because some of the students that were in that workshop were now in the federal government working in NOAA, was to come up with an international agreement to set up for a particular marine protected areas. And so I was and they announced that at a scientific meeting in Havana, Cuba that I was at. And at the time, Kathy Sullivan, who was the astronaut and the head of NOAA, went to Cuba to sign the agreement. And so I was standing in the hallway after they had done all that, and she came up to me and said, I knew her, and vice versa. And she said, "Larry, I just want to let you know that the reason that we're signing this international agreement, the first of its kind ever, is because of the workshop you had with your students 3 years ago." It was a really great feeling. Not only had we been working with students, we actually had a real impact on an international stage. So it's pretty wonderful.
Mm-hmm. How did that change when, in terms of like the U.S. relations with Cuba have been kind of back and forth between open and closed?
The relationship with Cuba have come up and down, and there have been under President Trump, they have really been more and more difficult. And to the point now, really, under his last set of executive orders, we really can't work in Cuba right now. We're not going, not for obviously the pandemic, but even before that. So it's just we can't work. It's almost impossible. We keep up communications and all that, but nothing can be done. So it has been incrementally more difficult to do things. We hope that under a new administration that will change. I mean, obviously, I and others think that's a mistake to isolate Cuba. I think the way you build relationships and change things is engagement and that type of thing. And there's wonderful scientists in Cuba. Of course, we have a long. We've been going to Cuba for 20 years. We've been in working with Cuba from an academic standpoint longer than, and we have more agreements, more relationships than any other university in the United States. I even wrote a an op-ed in Science to that end, to try to make that case, because it hadn't worked. And I hope that the new administration will open that back up so we can re-engage in Cuba in a way that we can, because science is international. I understand the differences in policies and the human rights issues, and those are difficult issues, and they have to direct things. But the way to build bridges, to provide science diplomacy, as I would call it, and others have called it, science diplomacy is really important and really valuable. And if you can keep the doors of science open, that gives you opportunity to move forward. Because it's a basic tenet that I operate on here at HRI anyway. As we try to, we're not confrontational. We're not advocates. We try to provide the best science and options and go that direction. And we try hard to find common ground. And that's kind of our theory, is that if you can find common ground between groups and stakeholders and others and build on that, then that gives you the opportunity to solve the problems where you can't agree. If you can build trust, build credibility with each other, then you can take on the tougher problems. I think that works internationally as well as here, that if you can find ways that you can work together, it builds those bridges to solve problems. Because if you're not talking with one another, if you're in your tribes, as it's been called these days, if you're tribal and these types of things, then obviously all you do is see each other as an enemy, not as someone with some common ground. And it's probably naive on my part. I've always operated under the idea that if you give people the right information, if you give them the information, they will make the right decision. I think most people are that way. If they have the right information and listen to it, they will make the right decision. I think that's true. I understand. I'm not naive enough to understand that subsets of those people are going to act on their own interests and own agendas. That happens. I get that. But I don't think I could live. I couldn't do what I do if my glass was half empty and not half full. And so I continue with that belief, and I think that internationally, it works internationally as well, that you need to come at it that way.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about, you've been in this business for 50 years and, what's changed and what's stayed the same over that, period of time?
Certainly from just the physical things, obviously things change more rapidly than you can think about. When you look at things, when I was at Parks and Wildlife, every year I used to get on one of our observation planes. I would fly the entire coast from Brownsville to Sabine. I would basically be laying on the bottom of the plane, looking through a big port window, taking photos to look at change. So that part of it obviously makes sense. That our coastline and have gotten far more crowded. We've developed more through and that type of thing. So. That kind of change has happened. It's probably not what you're talking about.
That part of it, right? Like, what have you seen in the physical world and then in kind of ideas and culture?
Yeah, I don't think people understand how much things have changed. And that's why looking at old photos from the 40s and 30s, even aerial photos and others compared now, you just can't imagine how much change has happened in the coastal environment with the building of cities and industry and what it was. And that's in our lifetime. And you can't imagine beyond that, two or three lifetimes. But in our lifetime, things have changed. And because of that change, issues of dealing with environmental issues have become much more complex. When Parks and Wildlife, before I got to Parks and Wildlife, during my time in the 30s, and 40s, even 50s, the main function of a state agency like Parks and Wildlife was to exploit the fisheries as much as possible. They were so abundant, shrimps and crabs and oysters and others were so abundant that you wanted to make maximum use of them. And so the focus was on getting as much out as you can. Today, it's just the opposite. We're over exploitation and people are here. So solutions to problems are far more complex. As we've talked about all along, science may not be easy, but it's straightforward. You can you can figure things out, and you can actually come up with solutions, science solutions, that are quite eloquent. But you can't use those solutions because of the potential negative impact on people that are all around us. So you have to take that. So I think that has been an issue. I do think, as we've discussed, that science has lost its sway, if you will, as the core of problem solving, and it's become far more ideological. As I tell people, famously, I don't know where I stole this from, but I did, is that, you know, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. But that doesn't stop them from acting on those opinions. And so what we have seen more and more is decisions that are agenda-driven and trying to submerge a scientific basis for it and then having to live with those results. So that has, and I think that's I think part of where science has failed, has not lived up to what it should be doing, and it is keeping itself relevant. Because at one time, you know, scientists were held in great esteem. I think they still are, in a sense, but not to the degree that where we were. So we have to regain that. And interestingly enough, I think this pandemic may help that, because of all things, the tremendous success we've had in generating these vaccines. I think it has shown the power of science. And so some things like that, I think, will help kind of reestablish it. But we set on a balance, I think, and from the environmental side of this, in just that, is that it's much more difficult to make an argument for protecting the environment, for making sure that environment are part of decisions, in the light of all the pressures we have from human issues that are overwhelming, of poverty and illiteracy and disease and all the things that that are so important to us as people. It's difficult to not put that off to the end. And unfortunately, those of us who have long-term concerns about that, you worry about tipping points and to the point that you get where you can't come back. I think we're still there. I think we can still, and we're trying to demonstrate that with this Deepwater Horizon. We have $18 or so billion. I think we've never had money like this before. Many of us are trying to focus as hard as we can on making sure that money has real impact, to show that if you invest in the environment to restore it, it does produce benefits, not only economic, but health and human well-being and for people as well. It's really important. It's where we live. And so I'm rambling a little bit, but that job is much more complex today than it ever has been. Now, like I said, my glass I try to keep half full. The students that are coming out these days, out of HRI, and others, and not just HRI, but the students in general, when I was at Parks and Wildlife, I kind of lost touch with students, and I missed that greatly. This is the thing I've enjoyed more here at HRI, being with HRI, than anything else, really, is the interaction with these young students, and they're brilliant. I couldn't even get into graduate school these days when I'm comparing myself to what these students, what they know and how they act and the perspective that they had. I was they are socially aware. They have many more tools at their hands to do things and that type. So I feel really good about the young people coming forward that's going to have to deal with much more complex issues. I think the capacity of our students to deal with these issues are growing with the severity of the problem. So I feel some optimism because of that.
Hmm. Nice. Okay. Oh, I think one of the things we had talked about yesterday that I wanted to have you kind of discuss and talk about is oysters and Galveston Bay and not only the destructive dredging, but then also the destructive oyster harvests. And so can you tell me more about how you got involved in that and then some of the initiatives at HRI to deal with it?
Yeah. Well, the oyster fishery is the last of the destructive fisheries that I wanted to deal with. We talked about dealing with shrimp and commercial fishermen and those types of things. This is the last bastion, I guess, of a fishery that is very destructive in its operations. And what I mean by that is that the oyster fishery, they use boats that have behind them dredges, which are big buckets with frankly metal teeth on them, and they drag them across the top of oyster reefs and collect the oyster shells, knock the shells off the reef, collect them up, and bring them on board. And so it destroys the very reef that these oysters create. And of course, oyster reefs are really important because of water quality. I mean, every individual oyster will filter as much as 50 gallons of water a day. So they're huge in that regard. They're habitat for all kinds of fish and so forth. So they're really important in ecosystem health. And of course, they have shoreline protection. They help deal with storm surges and all that. So they have many, many values besides eating them that should be preserved. So that has always been an issue for me, even when I was at Parks and Wildlife. And I started down that road, and the oyster fishermen are well organized. They're politically savvy. I'm not going to call them a mafia, but they're not the ones today. Historically, there have been some that are pretty difficult to work with. Because, for example, I started down in Parks and Wildlife. I was trying to set aside some regulations, and a couple of the industry members of the oystermen themselves were in Galveston, and they got up in front of the commission, and they were complaining about me that the regulations that I was proposing would put them all out of business. And this one particular oysterman who was there and he came dressed like an oysterman in coveralls and white rubber boots. And he said, "That blankety blank McKinney, you know, he's nothing but the socialist dupe of the nine dictators' chain dog." And I've never forgotten. This is now almost 30 years ago. And what a set of mixed metaphors. And the commissioners just sat there stunned. And later on, they produced a picture for me. And I don't know where it is anymore. With my picture and a big sentence says, "Here stands the socialist dupe of the nine dictators' chain dog," because I was the dupe. The chain dog was the executive director of Parks and Wildlife, and the nine dictators were, of course, the commissioners. So he managed to insult at the same time, and this is how they did it. He was up there trying to plead his case, yet he couldn't help himself. He had to insult everybody. So anyway, so that's how all that got started. So the point being is, so I've been involved in dealing with oysters and oystermen for many years, and we tried to do the same thing for the oyster industry as we did for the shrimp, but they would not yield. They would not allow us to put a limit on the number of oyster licenses. So I never got that done before I left Parks and Wildlife. But when I came to HRI, and after we had been here a while, we were very fortunate in that the President Miller was very supportive of HRI when she came on board as president, and she provided funding for three new chairs, Dr. Jennifer Pollack and Dr. Joe Fox being two of those, and Mike Witz was the third. And Dr. Pollack happens to be a certain regionally world-recognized expert on oyster ecology and ecosystem oystery, so she really knows them well. And Dr. Fox, who has a mariculture background, understanding those types of things. He's done it all around the world. And so when they came on board and I looked at all their expertise, it gave me that. I said, well, here's an opportunity. And Mike Wetz, even Dr. Wetz, who is a water quality expert, says, here's an opportunity to come at this oyster business again and maybe come up with a solution in that I couldn't, like I did with the shrimp industry, I couldn't buy them out like I did with the shrimpers, but maybe I can just help another industry get started that will outcompete them, and that is oyster farming and that type of thing. So we sat down together and talked about that as a possibility, and Dr. Fox actually wrote legislation. This is this HART model working, is it? Not only do we solve a problem, but we implement it. So he actually helped write the legislation that for the first time allowed oyster farms to be established in Texas. And the idea being is that if we can promote an oyster farms that will produce oysters at the right size and the right time for restaurants, that would decrease the need for dredging oyster reefs. It won't eliminate it, but it will decrease it and maybe get it down to a point where that fishery is less destructive. It will create a new industry for the coastline, but also do it in an environmentally sensitive way. And so we put that program together. And because of that proposal, we were able to attract the attention of the Ed Rochelle Foundation. And the Rochelle Foundation board has been very interested in helping doing something to improve the quality of our bays because of water quality issues and that type of thing. And they came to us and said, you know, if we could produce enough oysters to do restoration in our bays, do you think we could build or help accelerate oyster reef restoration to the point where it would help improve water quality in our bays? And then and we said, well, yeah, we could. And so what we're about to put together is the largest oyster restoration effort ever put together anywhere. There's a project going on in New York right now called the Billion Oyster Project, where they're putting a billion oysters into New York Harbor, and it's a wonderful outreach activity for students and all that. Our goal here, we think that once we get our hatchery built in Palacios and our research center built in North Beach, that we will produce some 5 billion oysters and have a 5 billion oyster project, a billion oysters in every bay in the state of Texas that can handle it, to work with oyster restoration to restore oysters all around and all together. So that's where we're going with this project. And I was just hoping to create a competitive atmosphere for oyster dredging with some other thing. Now it's grown into this truly a large-scale, unprecedented conservation program. Not necessarily for me. I just helped bring them together. It's because we have these wonderful scientists at HRI that have the capacity to actually make this happen.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Why wasn't there oyster farming in Texas before? Was it just because the wild fisheries were so productive? Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, to some extent. A big part of it was because of recreational fishermen, particularly Coastal Conservation Association. Some of the oyster farms that started on the East Coast and others were very large, 30 and 40 acres and spread out over part of the bays and that type of thing. So when that was developing in other states, CCA here was concerned that it would take up or destroy or take up too much area from recreational fishing. That it would take areas of the bay out of access to recreational fishing, so they discouraged it. And the CCA is a very powerful and effective conservation organization. They made their case to the commission, and so Parks and Wildlife and the legislature had to do it. The legislature would just not take it on. So that was one thing. And the other part of it was that the actual oyster fishery itself, the dredgers, did not want the competition. They were incredibly effective in the legislature and kept it out of contention. So what happened was, when we came on board, when Dr. Fox put it together, we have a wonderful relationship with CCA. They're one of our great partners in conservation. We sat down with them and talked about what their concerns were. Again, it's the HR model in action. When we have a problem, we brought the stakeholders together that we were working with and said, okay, what's your problem? And they told us. And so we figured out ways to put into the legislation, the state legislation, to address those issues. And CCA became supporters of oyster farms. And so that's how that turned around and became so powerful. And the fact that we made the case from a business standpoint, every other Gulf state has oyster farming. Texas doesn't. We need to have oyster farming to compete. And by the way, it's going to create thousands of jobs and economic impact. That speaks powerfully with the Texas legislature these days, as you might expect, because of economic situations. So we had CCA support. We made the case that it was an industry that would create jobs. That was pretty hard to fight against, and so it was successful.
Nice. Okay. What have I missed about Hart? I mean, you're the expert.
Well, we did talk. One thing we could talk about is our snapper, red snapper, and the commission that I worked on. That was one thing. That was probably the most important thing that I've done here at HRI from a contributing to environment side has been that I was asked to chair a commission on the recreational fishing, and it was put together by Johnny Morris, who's the head of Bass Pro, and a fellow named John Deal, who's a boat builder, a world famous boat builder, Scott Deal, and the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Organization, they're not very active here in Texas, but as a conservation organization, the Teddy Roosevelt group is well known internationally. And so they became very interested. And so they put the commission together with the idea that they felt that recreational fishing was not being managed well on a federal basis, and then the commercial fisheries were overshadowing it, and it was a great conservation and economic loss. And so I was asked to chair a commission that brought together the absolute best fishery scientists in this country, and ergo the world, to look at the problem over a period of about a year. We brought in all kinds of experts and others to testify, and to try to create some simple recommendations for did we make sure that recreational fishing was properly put in the model of how you manage fisheries in the U.S. Because the main oversight, the federal guidance to fisheries, is the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And that's what guides how we manage fisheries in this country. And it's very focused on commercial fisheries, which is understandable. When it was first put into place, that was the big issue. Because we were having huge, we had foreign fleets, Chinese and Russian trawlers coming into U.S. waters and taking fish and all those types of things. So the original Magnuson Act helped establish those 200-mile economic zones to keep fisheries out and all of that. But it was very, very focused. And the commercial fishing industry was very powerful, and taking for fish that also had recreational value, like redfish, which are both commercial and recreational, they were so powerful that they were getting allocations of all those fish. And so recreational anglers and the industry that supported them, were taking the hit. So they wanted to have this commission that had a group of scientists that would make some recommendations of how to rectify this, how to better balance out recreational and commercial fishing, and that's what we did over a period of a year. And we came up with recommendations on things like establishing a national policy for recreational fishing. Seems simple enough, hadn't been done, we got that done. We made recommendations on how to better allocate a fish between the commercial side and the recreational side so it was more equitably balanced. Made recommendations on how to restore fish stocks, and this was a big one, because if you're commercially oriented, if there's a fish stock that's going down, you want to recover it as quickly as possible so that you can begin again return to extracting the maximum amount of meat from it. And so the Federal Magnuson Act treated recreational species just like it. They said, okay, if a recreational species is starting to decline, we'll just shut the fishery down until it's recovered, and then when it's recovered, we'll open the fishery again. Well, see, that they don't think about the fact that this recreational fishery depends, it's not a meat industry. It depends on people hiring guides, coming to town to stay in hotels, restaurants, coastal communities. All coastal communities depend on this continual happening. Well, if you shut it down for 5 years, what's going to happen to all these people and industries? They're all going to disappear, and then when you open the fishery again, they're not there. So you have to think about how you recover species more gradually so that you minimize it. And there were things like managing the forage base, that you had to actually take care of the forage base and things. And the biggest one is that absolute best managers of recreational fisheries have been the states. The federal agency, National Marine Fisheries Service, is primarily a commercial-based operation. they understand how to manage commercial, regulate commercial fisheries. They have little to no experience in the recreational side. So they tend to treat recreational fisheries just like commercial fisheries, and they're completely different. But states, on the other hand, have long experience in how to manage recreational. So there's lots of lessons to be learned. And so it would seem to make sense that we should have cooperative management between federal and state agencies to promote all of that. So we made those kinds of recommendations. And we put that in 2017, we put that report out. And within a year, Congress had taken it up. I and several others testified, and Dr. Stuntz as well, testified in front of Congress on several occasions about this. And interesting enough, the Congress put together what was called the Modern Fish Act, which incorporated every one of our recommendations except forage. We missed forage. Somehow it got left out. I don't understand. We missed that one. But all the other recommendations got into it. It was called the Modern Fish Act. And it was passed by a House and Senate almost unanimously. And in December, this time of year, where we're talking about having this discussion right now, at the end of December, President Trump signed it into law. So that's probably the most successful, for me, from translating science into political action on the biggest stage that I could possibly go at, except I guess maybe you could go in front of the UN and do something, but this is big enough, national level. So this is the greatest impact that I've ever had on taking science and actually making concrete changes in the way things will be from now and going into the future. So it was really satisfying in that regard.
Yeah. How did that make you feel at the time?
Relieved to some extent, because we had put an awful lot of effort into it, and these things can easily get derailed. I've obviously worked with Congress and state legislators, and I understand as they talk about sausage, and if you like sausage, don't go see it being made, and that's what happens, and it could be derailed at any time, and that could have happened any time. It did not, and it was successful, but that was one. Relief was one. But after the relief part disappeared, it's very satisfying to think what will happen, what I've done. And I say me, but it was a huge effort. Many, many people. I was just a little cog in it, really. But just being part of that my son and people's daughters, sons and daughters, will have the opportunity to actually really fish and to enjoy the same things that I did. That will not disappear. That 20 years from now, that will be there because of what we did. It will still happen, and so that's one part of it. But the other is that what most people don't understand is that recreational fishing, because of the taxes on the equipment that they buy back to states for conservation purposes and the licenses that are sold, big parts of them. This the most. It generates more conservation dollars. There's more to restore habitat, water quality, and protect endangered species than any other source of funds from anywhere. That those monies will still be there. We'll still be doing that in the future. The biggest financial contributor to conservation that ever has been will continue because of what we did under that act. So that's. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
By the way, we're trying to do that in Cuba as well. That's our big Cuba project. We're focused right now, and we've gotten great support from other foundations, and of course, it's on a hiatus right now. But the Cuban agencies have come to us and asked me and some others and HRI to help lead a group, and we have a big group working with trying to help them develop a recreational fishery that will be sustainable and have all the same benefits that we've been talking about here. So I'm hoping that will, when we get back with Cuba, we'll be able to take what we've learned here and help them do the same thing, so they'll have a sustainable fishery in Cuba, recreational fishery as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that would be a big draw for tourists.
Well, it is now, as a matter of fact. They just don't know how to manage it because they don't have experience either. They're at that stage where they've only, they've been meat fishermen. It's been commercial. commercialized to some extent, and there's people trying to take advantage of them from the outside, different companies from outside countries, outside of Cuba, that are making a lot of money on a recreation, are managing recreational fisheries in Cuba right now for the government, and that should be the people. What we want is to allow the coastal communities to take the lead, and so they'll have a source of income. So that they'll have a stake in protecting the environment, because they'll be making money off of recreational fishing. Again, it's this multiple thing. The people that live on these coastal communities now, and it happens all around the world as well, when you're in these little fishing communities, for the most part, they're impoverished. So they're trying to eat. I mean, they're subsistence. You know, they have to catch as many fish as they can just to survive. But if they could come up with an industry, recreational fishing, where they can be guides, And those types of things, provide hotels and places to stay, they make money off the fish as long as the fish are there, because then they have a real economic stake in conservation and protecting the environment, protecting the fishery, because they need them there. So you don't have to worry about police so much anymore, or regulations, because they have an economic stake in it. So you build that cycle, and that's what we want to see in Cuba, is for those communities to get to have a stake in protecting the fisheries, because that's how they live.
How have you seen that? I mean, those stakes with recreational fishermen change over time in Texas.
I think Texas is a wonderful success story, and that's one of the successes that Parks and Wildlife and the Coastal Conservation Association, which really led it. I mean, this is where they played a huge role. Is that we, and during my time at Parks and Wildlife, that shift really concluded then, that we became a fisheries agency that manages for recreational fishing rather than commercial. Commercial is a secondary. We recognize that recreational fishing is the economic driver, and in order to have recreational fishing, you have to have good water quality, you have to have habitat, and so that's supported all those activities. And so and we generate a lot of money. So Texas is a recreationally focused management agency now, to that benefit. So it's changed completely from that degree, to that degree.
How much are recreational fishers and conservation organizations in Texas focused on freshwater inflow?
I'm sorry.
How much, this kind of group, this lobby, how much are they focused on freshwater inflow?
It is a core issue for all of them. There are entire programs, Living Waters programs, that have been funded by the Walton Family Foundation, that have brought together like the National Wildlife Federation, the Nature Conservancy, the Sierra Club, and that's the main core group, but probably some others as well. They all do work together on water and freshwater inflow issues, so they're very effective. And it's high on their number one issue. With CCA, they have other issues too, but CCA is, freshwater inflow is a big issue for them. And I think, as I said, when I was back in Parks and Wildlife and legislature, CCA was protecting me all the time as I was fighting reservoirs that would cut off freshwater inflows. They had my back, and that type of thing. So it's a very important issue, very high end. Fortunately, it is. And I've worked hard to try to help these organizations have the science to make that case to their members, because they have to convince their members that this is an important issue. And so, for example, I don't write a lot of scientific papers anymore. I don't do that, but I have many, many articles in Parks and Wildlife magazines and others about water and fresh water to try to help build that issue. So I think that has been successful to some extent to keep it high on their list.
Mm-hmm. What else do you want to tell me about your time at HART?
Well, I'm looking at that. I wrote anything down. We've been going for a while. That's good. Trying to think of anything to cover. We got international. We talked about international issues. We talked about students. I don't know. I think we pretty well covered it. As far as I can, I think we have covered everything.
Well,
I guess one of the things that we're now kind of moving into a little bit, David, Dr. Yaskowitz is trying to figure out how to do is that we are trying to stand up this Center for the Environment and Economy, which one of the things that we're seeing all around, you know, around Corpus Christi is this huge economic development. I mean, and for example, I sit here at the HRI building and I can look out the window and look across the entire Corpus Christi Bay over toward Port Aransas. And just in the 12 years that I've been here, the entire shoreline has filled up. And it's an interesting panorama because on one end of the bay, when the weather's clear and you see nothing but the windmills that generate the, you know, electricity, those types of things, the wind-driven turbines. And then as you go down the coast, you see the development of, you see steel mills. Then you begin to see oil and gas platforms or tanks, and then these areas where they build these huge offshore platforms. So the industrialization of that shoreline on the opposite side is incredible. Is that, if I understand it correctly, there's probably something like $30 or $40 billion worth of industrial development still to come there. So we're seeing Corpus Christi Bay. And the port, of course, and one of the reasons, of course, this is all driving this is the Eagle Ford Shale oil and gas that are coming through Corpus Christi. And at some point in the future, Corpus Christi will be exporting more oil and gas than goes through the Straits of Hormuz in the Middle East. This is how significant this will be, because the oil and gas from the Permian Basin is also coming through here. So it's a huge development. So it's a wonderful... I shouldn't say wonderful, but it's a great test bed for figuring out, can you actually balance economic development and protection of the environment? Can you make sure that Corpus Christi Bay and all the waters around us are still something that tourists will come to, that we want to live around, that we don't turn Corpus Christi Bay into just another giant sewage treatment plant? Can we do that? Can you actually have economic development and keep the environment in balance with one another? And we're standing up this Center for Environment and Economy. We actually have a building downtown, the old Penny's building that the university has purchased. We're going to have a floor on that. And our whole idea is to take what we have learned over the last 20 years and the expertise that not only we have in the institute, but that exists in the university. There's a lot of expertise in the university that we could be a conduit to help bring together with the industry side to make sure we can have economic health and environmental health. So if we can do that here, perhaps we could export those ideas to other places of how to keep this balanced. That's the goal. So I'm sorry to some extent that I'm retiring and will not be able to be here to see that grow and develop. I think it's going to be really important. But the person that's in charge of HRI right now, Dr. Yaskowitz, who is a socioeconomist, an economist, probably is the absolute best person to be in position to help try to balance all that. So I think that's going to be the next important, one of the important areas that HRI will grow in the future. So I'm excited about that, and it's much needed.
All right. Well, I'm going to, if there's not anything else, I think I'll turn the recorder off.